My name is Kennedy Sam, and you're listening to Conversations with Creative Waco on KWBU. On this program, we sit down with leaders in the arts and cultural sector to discuss some cool things that are happening in our creative community. Today, we are sitting down with Eric Shepherd, Executive Director of the Waco Civic Theater, to hear more about the season thus far and what's in store for their few remaining shows of the season. Later on, we'll hear the segment David in Art with David Smith. But first, I'd like to welcome Fiona Bond, Executive Director of Creative Waco, to join me for a roundup of February's events and to share some events to keep on your calendar for the upcoming months. Hey, Fiona, how's it going?
Going really well. Thanks. Hi, Kennedy.
So February has been a busy month, and it seems like we're starting to say that about every month.
I know. It used to be this was a relatively quiet part of the year, but we definitely can't say that now.
Yeah, so we kicked off the beginning of this month with the Faith and Family Film Fest and MCC's Black History Month concert, all which were amazing.
And tremendously well attended, too, yes. Which was great to see. Yeah, some really super events there.
So we also had a big month for Creative Waco. The Sculpture Zoo is done.
It is. Yes, we've had so much great feedback from people who just love walking along the riverbank, seeing the sculptures. And we are really delighted that we can enhance people's experience now because thanks to a grant from Texas Commission on the Arts, we've been able to create a website that goes with every single one of the sculptures.
Right. And this is completely interactive as well, right?
Yes, there's an interactive map. And you can dive into the whole project, find out a little bit more about how the project came to be, who's behind it, the judges, for example, you know, the jurors that look through the applications from all over the United States from artists hoping to participate in it. And then you can actually find out more about each one of the individual sculptures.
And this is zoo@creativewaco.org.
zoo.creativewaco.org. Yes.
Yes.
And so, with each of the sculptures, you can see who it was that sponsored it, who created it. You can find out about the animals in the zoo or in the area that it represents. And you can find out kind of the cool stories behind them. So, for example, there's a lovely one by artist Meg White of an elephant, little baby elephant, just kind of strolling along. And that's based on a story about an elephant, a true story about an elephant that was born disabled and had to learn to walk thanks to the tenacity of the baby and its mom and the humans that were in its life. And it learned to walk. And so that one, Eli Playing with a Stick is the name of the piece, is all about overcoming disability.
Well, that's awesome. Thank you so much for joining us, Fiona. And you can check it out at zoo.creativewaco.org.
You're listening to 103.3 Waco Public Radio. Should all government buildings have to conform to one particular style of architecture? Here's David Smith with this week's edition of David and Art.
Last week, I mentioned former President Theodore Roosevelt's harsh disapproval of some contemporary art in the 1913 New York exhibit. He was critical of paintings that he felt didn't meet his standards of what art ought to look like, and was particularly dismissive of European modernists. You will have noticed, perhaps, that the current president is likewise outspoken in his cultural opinions. Earlier this month, the publication Architectural Record explained that in the middle of the impeachment drama, the White House was drafting a new executive order to regulate the architecture of government buildings. Entitled Making Federal Buildings Beautiful Again, it orders that classical Greek and Roman architecture now be the preferred and default style for new buildings as well as those being remodeled. It holds that newer, more creative styles are an outrage. It calls out new federal buildings in San Francisco, Miami, and Austin, all of which were designed between 2007 and 2012, as being affronts to the good taste of everyday Americans. Back in 1962, an official in the Kennedy administration named Daniel Patrick Moynihan said that despite there being guiding principles for federal architecture, an official style must be avoided. Design must flow from the architectural profession to the government, he said, and not vice versa. As a mechanism for ensuring that the classical design now becomes the standard, this executive order creates something called the President's Committee for the Re-Beautification of Federal Architecture. New York Times architecture critic Michael Kimmelman characterizes this as a war on architectural diversity. He points out that for decades, the United States has exercised its soft power in the world by building its embassies and other government buildings with an architectural nonconformity that conveys a subtle but powerful message of optimism, innovation, and freedom. Professional organizations like the National Trust for Historic Preservation, the Society of Architectural Historians, and the American Institution of Architects have all come out unequivocally against this proposed executive order. I've commented publicly before about the pleasure of architectural diversity and the utter drabness of towns and cities wherever it is absent. Surveying this order within the landscape of today's politics, one is left with the suspicion that, among other things, this is just another rather transparent way to divide the American population into us and them without any real serious regard for the health of art and architecture. Which is to say that, once again, politicians are using the arts to exacerbate differences rather than to underscore our common humanity.
You can find this and other episodes on our website, kwbu.org. Just look for David and Art in the Programs tab.
Welcome back. You are listening to Conversations with Creative Waco on KWBU, and I'm your host, Kennedy Sam. We are back and sitting down with Eric Shepherd, who serves as the Executive Director of the Waco Civic Theater. Eric, thank you for joining us today.
I'm delighted to be here. Thank you for asking.
Well, I wanted to start off and say welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
It's been about 2 years since you were here last. And, you know, the last time you were here, you weren't only over one theater. You were over two theaters.
That's right.
In two different cities.
Yes.
So how have you been adjusting since moving back from the Vive La Arts Theater in Killeen? And, you know, now you're primarily working with the Waco Civic Theater.
It's great. I do appreciate it. I think that I thought that I could do that more easily than I turned out to be able to do it. It's two very big jobs, and I wanted to do it because I wanted theater to survive, and it's surviving, so I'm happy to say that. But it was time to allow someone else to come in, and Jamie, who's taken over, is doing a great job. So not only was I happy to leave it, I was happy to leave it in good hands.
That's awesome. I know you're glad that you don't have to make that trip down I-35 right about now.
Mm-hmm, yes. Today is kind of cold and chilly, and it wouldn't be a pleasant commute.
Yeah. So you took over that theater during a tumultuous time for that organization. Do you feel like you were able to accomplish whatever goals that you had set?
Yes. The important thing was to keep the place going and to get it back in the black, and we were able to do that. It also seemed important to reestablish confidence in the organization, in the community, and I think we did that as well. So I'm happy that we were able to get it back on solid footing.
That's awesome. So you were working with the theater before you even stepped in as a temporary executive director. Mm-hmm. How did the programming change, or did the organization as a whole change during your entire time there?
Well, it about tripled in size, and so that was really helpful in terms of the budget. We were able to produce more and better theater. We started a children's theater, which hadn't existed before. We initiated school day matinees for all of the children's theater shows, and we began to appeal to a much broader swath of the community, and that meant that that community theater represented its community in a way that it never had before. It was much more inclusive, and I'm really happy with those accomplishments.
That's awesome. So how did you get into theater? How did you find your passion for this?
I think it has always been a passion of mine, but I didn't have the right timing or opportunity. I moved to New York to try to make it as an actor twice and ran out of money both times before I hit stardom.
Yeah.
I was at a teaching conference because I used to teach gifted and talented kids, and one of the tools that I used was theater to teach, and I ran into the director of the master's directing program here at Baylor, and he said, you should come and get a master's degree in theater because I can see it's a gift that you have. And it took me about 18 months to believe him that that was really the thing to do. And once I did, things really changed for me. I found that I really had a natural inclination for doing work as a director. I loved the teaching that I was getting. And before I finished my degree, I had the job in Killeen directing their theater.
Awesome.
And I learned on the job while I was there because it's such a fascinating and deep field that I was able to both do the job and learn about the job. And the more I knew about it, the more I liked it. It was a combination of all the things that happened in my life as a teacher, as a furniture mover, all the things that actors do to survive as actors, at some point came to help me out in running a theater.
So do you also hit the stage occasionally?
Or from time to time, yes. Yeah, about once a year I'll do a role.
Awesome.
Usually when we run shy of the number of men needed for a production, but yes.
So as executive director, what is your role when it comes to planning this season and when it actually comes to executing the shows?
The season is planned by a committee of interested people, one of whom is a retiree who has been working with our theater for over 20 years. There's a Baylor professor. We have a community member, and we have a faculty member from MCC. And we all bring ideas to the table. There's a few others who check in from time to time, a guy who was an equity actor and is now a financial planner. But there are people who bring us suggestions, and we come to a meeting in usually September of the year, and then we'll meet again in October or November and try to come up with a season that is representative of our community in terms of the talent that we have available, the things that tend to interest people, shows that have done success in the past, newer works, and there's a lot of give and take. And after about 2 or 3 months of meeting, about once a month, we kind of come to a consensus, assuming that all those shows are going to be available when we're going to do them. Sometimes, like Mamma Mia, was a brand new show.
Right.
And we actually got permission to do it before they announced it to the public. So we didn't get it before any other theater, but we were able to plan to get it.
That's awesome.
Which is nice.
Yeah.
Yes. So I'm a member of that committee, and I would say I'm a pretty influential member of that committee, but it's not just me.
Right. So is there a method to picking a season? Like, do you have a couple of big name, highly recognizable shows that you guys do and then sprinkle in some smaller ones?
Yes. Our income is driven a lot by season ticket holders, and you want to appeal to that constituency. And what that means is that we need to make sure that at least two of the shows are going to be really recognizable, whether they're classic shows like, My Fair Lady or Oklahoma, which we did a few years ago. And those shows by themselves can sell a season because people look at the lineup and they go, okay, I want to see that. And then you try to sprinkle in works that are maybe less well-known or might appeal to a less broad or maybe a different demographic. And so one of the other factors is musicals. Those sell better than non-musicals.
Really?
Yes. It's very clear that that's the case. They also cost more, so you have to think about that as well. Since I've been here, since 2013, over the 6 or 7 years, we have gradually moved from doing very few musicals to almost all musicals because that's what people want to see.
Mm-hmm.
So we're always looking for either something that our audience hasn't seen or maybe something that is familiar but not in the way that they think of it.
Right.
So you are trying to satisfy your existing customers who tend to be more conservative, but you're also trying to attract people who might be more adventurous. So it's a balance between all those factors.
So you guys run shows about every other month or so?
On the main stage, yes.
Yeah,
but
stage.
We sprinkle fundraising shows and children's theater shows. So we do 13 or 14 shows a year.
Wow.
So it's more than one
yeah.
a month.
So how do you keep like a steady pool of actors that you're choosing from?
There seems to be almost an inexhaustible source of talent
really?
Here.
That
yes.
Awesome.
We might not have the numbers that you have in a larger city, but with Baylor, with MCC, with TSTC, and the graduates of those programs and spouses, there are an awful lot of talented people in our area. And if you continue to do good work, they will find you. We have people who were, like the guy I mentioned a minute ago, who is a former equity actor, made his living doing theater, but now is a financial planner. So we have people like that, Baylor professors who used to work professionally, Baylor faculty who are experts in this field or other fields who also have talent. And so our area is really blessed with talent. So the challenge seems to be getting exactly the right actor for each particular part, not do we have talented people in our area.
So do you see a lot of growth within your actors the more that they participate in different shows, or is it?
Absolutely. Yeah. There are people that we can point to in particular who might not have ever done a show before. There are others who had done it many years ago, and there are others who needed or wanted a creative outlet. And there are people who have done this before who continue to hone their craft, either working with our directors and designers, or they go out and get lessons because they want to be better at it, or it's a passion of theirs, and so they work at it so that they hone their craft so that they can feel better and better about each performance.
So what's the typical lead time between auditions and then the time that they hit the stage?
Not enough. with a crowded schedule,
yeah.
And though I say there's lots of actors, there is a limited, you know, pool. It's about 6 weeks.
6 weeks.
So we'll audition this particular show we're working on right now, Emma, the Jane Austen novel. We auditioned about 2 weeks ago. And because there are specialty costumes from, you know, the early 1800s, Regency wear, and early Victorian clothes that have to be tailored specifically for the people in the show, we've allowed a little extra time. That's unusual for us. When we audition and work on The Music Man, it will be 6 weeks from start to finish.
Yeah. I was also going to ask, so when you're planning out your season, when it comes down to costume and set design, how do you choose, like, shows that have the same kind of theme so you can reuse costumes, or are you starting from scratch each time?
We start from scratch pretty much each time. If there's a way that we can sort of join forces in a way with particular shows, certainly. We just closed a double feature, if you will, of Always Patsy Cline and Hank Williams' Lost Highway. And so we were able to use the same set for that show and most of the same musicians, but different costumes, different casts for each.
So how does running a show concurrent with another one work logistically?
It's project management, I guess.
Yeah.
You know, if you are fortunate enough to have dedicated and committed people working on both shows, they find a way to work around each other. We do, because of a grant that we got from the Cooper Foundation, we now have a separate rehearsal space from our performance space. So we, and of course, what we did is completely take advantage of that. And instead of doing two shows at the same time, we now do three or four at the same time.
Yeah.
So you've got folks in one room with one set of creative folks working on things that can be worked on in that room, because not each room isn't the same as being in the space. So we have a room that's really best suited for doing musical rehearsal. We have another one that is, it's also our event room, but it's a good dance studio. And then we have the stage. And, you know, good Lord willing, creek doesn't rise.
Yeah.
We'll make enough money in the next couple of years to actually build a second performance space in our building, which can be used both as rehearsal and performance space.
So what does a successful season or show look like for you guys?
Well, I guess in terms of raw numbers, if we're above 80% capacity, then we are doing well with that show. Some do closer to 95, like Always Patsy Cline. We sold every single seat for that show that we could and then ran out of seats. So that was
That's great success.
Yeah. And that is closer to the norm. You know, 90% capacity is about what we do these days, which is great. Anyone who's tried to fill a concert hall at a church says 90%, that's pretty good. So a theater, same rule. One of the other things that measures success is our own benchmarks, I suppose. Do we feel like we did the work that we set out to do justice? Did we have the right cast? Did we have the right crew? Did we have the right sets, costumes, props, that sort of thing? And so we'll meet after each of the shows and figure out how well did we do on this and what can we do to do better. And the other, I guess, would be audience feedback. Sometimes you can sell a show and it doesn't grow your audience. And so all of our shows are intended to make sure that we get more and more people coming back. And that is why you wouldn't want to do, though you could sell lots of tickets. I think we could probably do an entire season of just doing Oklahoma because it's the most popular musical ever. It is not quite as available. It's more available than Phantom of the Opera, which you know may or may not happen one day. But there's very few shows like it. So we could run that all the time, but it wouldn't grow our audience.
Right.
It wouldn't change our reputation. It wouldn't allow us to reach new people. So one of the things we're trying to do always is to try to make sure that we're more and more involved in the community in all the ways that we can be.
Right. So with your season about two-thirds over, mm-hmm. what can we expect from Jane Austen's Emma and The Music Man, which are the two last shows?
I think that I'm excited about the next two shows for a couple of reasons. One, the look and feel of Emma is great, and there's a movie coming out in America, February 21st, in Great Britain on the 14th, a new adaptation of it. So people are clearly interested in the story. Music Man, we have a first-time director, a woman who's kind of grown up at our theater. She's kind of a Baylor story. She's a Baylor faculty member. Her parents were missionaries. She's done this show three times as an actor, and now she's going to be the director of the show. So it's a growth opportunity for her, and I'm excited about that, too.
Awesome. So with all your free time, you're also an instructor at UMHB, University of Mary Harden Baylor.
Mm-hmm.
What are you teaching there?
I teach one class each semester called Intro to Theater, and it's a fine arts elective. So I have a class of, let's call it, between 10 and 15 students, one or two of whom are really interested in theater, and it's one of the few theater classes that they're able to offer down there. And then I have people who are kind of interested in the arts, but also have to take an elective. And then I've got some folks who are like, I heard this was an easy class. So it's a mixed bag, you know. And so I really enjoy it because it allows me to nerd out on theater twice a week and tell them about how fantastic theater is in all its aspects. And they get to participate as well. And it, I hope, enlivens their interest in the art form, which is admittedly not as popular as some other arts.
So what do you enjoy the most about what you're doing right now?
What do I enjoy the most? I think it's the opportunity to grow and learn.
Mm-hmm.
Every show, there's new subject material, right? in Emma, I'm learning more and more about the fashion, the social customs, pronunciation, pronunciation, names and places, that sort of thing. If I were doing a show about the Industrial Revolution, I would take a look at all of the history that took place during that time period. I would learn about, you know, the science and technology that were present at the time. And that's one aspect of what I do. Another is that because we're a growing theater, I'm consistently learning about new and better practices with theaters that are larger than ours or developments in business strategies or procedures or policies that enable companies to thrive. And so it's always challenging. And that's what I love about it. There's never a dull day at the office. It's never, humdrum sort of. I'm doing the same thing over and over again. And I guess that's what I love about it is that it keeps surprising me.
That's awesome. So the Waco Civic Theater and you guys are also very involved in the process right now with Keene Independent for the consultation for the feasibility of a performing arts facility in our community. What has been one of your key takeaways from this whole conversation?
I think one of them is that even though it's a person's name, they are aptly named Keene Consulting. They ask some really incisive questions.
Mm-hmm.
And they are very inquisitive and are interested in carrying the conversation as far as the people who are involved in it want to take it. I have been on a panel. I've been individually interviewed. I've been with a group that toured our theater. And they seem really open to a wide variety of viewpoints, and they bring different kinds of expertise to the process. And I really have admired the parts of the process that I have seen.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think whatever they recommend for the city will have been very well thought out, well researched, and will represent if you will, the will of the people.
That's awesome. So how do you believe the arts and the cultural community will be impacted if there is a centralized location for other arts and cultural events?
I don't know if this idea is becoming an antiquated idea, but it seems to me that any city that has a large performing arts facility, particularly in the downtown areas, are cities that can point to the commitment of their city and can say, as people in this area, whatever the area happens to be, we are proud of and we celebrate our accomplishments. Mm-hmm. So any city worth aspiring to be values the arts, and it has a visible manifestation of it, of a large structure of some kind that says we value visual art, we value performing art, we value architecture itself.
Right.
And our city is staking a claim to being part of the larger cultural landscape. And so I am encouraged by the fact that our city is moving that direction, and I, for me, it can't move fast enough to get to a place. And we have such a great setting along the Brazos River. That's my personal bias, mm-hmm. is that it needs to be along the river, along with the cathedral to football that is on the other side of the river
right there.
And I think having a large art facility along with the suspension bridge and the branding the Brazos and McLean Stadium says Waco is all those things. And it seems important to me that we make that statement. And that's a separate thing entirely from having adequate facilities for our arts groups to practice their artwork,
right,
which I think is also, you know, worthwhile in and of itself.
Well, awesome. Thank you, Eric, so much for sitting down with us today.
Glad to be here. Thank you for asking me.
The Waco Civic Theater's next show, Jane Austen's Emma, will run March 27th through April 5th. Tickets are on sale now. This conversation will be posted on kwbu.org. You can also visit creativewaco.org/blog for content related to this episode. Catch the next episode on Friday, March 27th for more deep dives into local arts and culture. This has been Conversations with Creative Waco on KWBU, and I'm your host, Kennedy Sam. Thanks for tuning in.